any great show has to have the elements that come together. Great scripts, great acting, great direction, and in a cartoon, great timing.
I think that, of course, it overlaps into all other societies, but there are many aspects of it that is very unique to the American life, and it's done with an eye toward a comedic or humorous view, an assessment of what that way of life is.
It was like we could relate to people of another era in a fun way. We know it's a universal truth that all of the little problems we have in our daily lives did happen 3 centuries ago, 10 centuries ago, you know, way back in the prehistoric days. You know, they still had problems with your mother-in-law or your boss. You know, these are universal problems. These things don't go away.
I think it's because the Flintstones are very specific characters, but yet they're generic enough that people can kind of imprint on them.
I've met so many people over the decades that are just crazy about it. I meet guys, mostly got more than girls, I think, that just, they say, I grew up on Hanna-Barbera. I watched it all the time, and, you know, such fans. Yeah. And it's great. I really appreciate it to have been part of all this that brought this to these people.
Flintstones are the crowning jewel in the Hanna-Barbera legacy. Animation was never really regarded as a kid's thing when it started in the 1910s and the 1920s. And into the 30s, 40s, and 50s, they were shown in movie theaters. When television came in, animation, old animation from the 30s or whatever, were shown on television for kids. They were slotted in Saturday morning slots. They were slotted in the afternoons for kids and kiddie shows, that kind of thing. This was in the early days, the 50s of television, where there was no original animation done for television.
Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera, who had been doing 7-minute cartoons for probably 30 years or more by that point, and suddenly they want to go into this new area.
Hanna-Barbera left MGM. In fact, MGM closed the doors on their studio, and they had to kind of reinvent themselves. And the only place that was showing animation was television. So their very first shows, like Rough and Ready and Huckleberry Hound, were aimed at children.
I remember Time magazine ran a big article on the Huckleberry Hound show. I mean, it was just, I bet the network just probably got ratings numbers like they'd never had before.
They became so successful about it, and Joe Barbera in particular was such a good salesman in selling the networks and the executives on ideas for TV cartoons that he convinced them that a cartoon, just the way they used to do it, just the way Tom and Jerry used to appeal to adults in theaters, could be done for television. And that really was the seed of the Flintstones.
Ed Benedict, of course, is the one who designed the Flintstones.
And Ed had worked for Tex Avery at MGM.
Ed Benedict influenced the early Hanna-Barbera designs in general, Yogi Bear and, you know, Quick Draw McGraw and the Flintstones. He had a kind of an abstract way of drawing, and it was perfect for this simplistic design style for TV animation.
But he had a real strong flat UPA-like design style, which I think they felt would not only be simple to animate, but it was very bold. It had a very, very strong outlines. It would read on TV sets no matter how bad the reception was. And he's a brilliant designer.
Well, Hanna-Barbera had a little factory system going. They were producing limited animation for television on a weekly basis, on a very low budget. Now they were going to do a half-hour show they were proposing. The budget would have to be higher. It was for prime time. The show itself was a full 24 minutes of new animation for, you know, a week for this one particular show. When they did Huckleberry Hound, that was a 6-minute cartoon. Yogi Bear, 6-minute cartoons. They hadn't done a half hour. No one had done a half hour sitcom, animated sitcom before. This was totally a new thing.
The first title on the show was The Flagstones.
And then it became The Gladstones, and then it became The Flintstones.
And there are model sheets where it says The Gladstones, and you can see it crossed out, and The Flintstones is written in. So it went through several names before it became Flintstones. And in fact, they even animated, I think it's about a 3-minute pilot called The Flagstones.
The pilot was an attempt to nail all the characters, give you some sense of the world they lived in.
Wilma, when are we going shopping?
As soon as I serve His Majesty's lunch. He's dining at the pool today. Where's Barney?
Oh, he's trying on his gear.
Hiya, Fred. And what are you made up for?
I'm gonna practice spear fishing.
Oh, you can't lose. You'll either spear him or they'll die laughing.
It was a gag involved in the swimming pool, which wound up becoming the pilot episode.
In the Flagstones pilot, the only voice that's the same is Gene Vanderpyle doing Wilma. You have June Foray, who was the voice of Rocky the Squirrel, doing Betty. And Doss Butler, who is a very famous Hanna-Barbera voice, who is Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quickdraw McGraw, Snagglepuss, and a host of others, does both Fred and Barney in the pilot.
They pretty much nailed the style from the beginning. I mean, Fred has that more ruffled hair with more points on it. If you look at some of the early episodes of the show, there are scenes from that do turn up in those shows, because you can tell because Fred has that real mop of hair instead of the one with 5 points. He has 2 points in front and 3 in the back. And Fred has 2 hairs, and Barney only has 1 that comes to the crown of his head.
The format of the show was very much like a sitcom of the era. You know, a husband and wife, what the husband's life is like at home, what the husband's life is like at the office. Not unlike other sitcoms of the time.
Fred, you were closing your eyes.
Yeah, that's right. I was closing my eyes. Right. Have they passed a law against it?
Well, you can't.
They even had a laugh track. You know, which was, because most sitcoms were done in front of a live audience. Or even if they weren't, they had a laugh track. So the Flintstones had to have that, too.
And, Mr. Slate, I appreciate you'd like me working for you again. However, before I do, there's something I must tell you. Yes, Flintstone? Well, Mr. Slate?
As a kid, I could never figure out what cartoons were doing with laugh tracks. Even as a little kid, I was sophisticated enough to know these were cartoons that were made over a period of time and that they weren't showing them to an audience.
We discovered that it does help the feeling of a laughing spirit or a comedic spirit to the show in itself. For some reason, a laugh track does do that.
They had all the conventions of a sitcom, of course. It was the central couple and the next-door neighbors, the wacky next-door neighbors, and, of course, the boss and the pet. You know, they had all the trappings of a typical suburban home. Like the typical sitcom of the era, they had an opening theme song, you know, and they were sponsored.
One thing that's confusing to fans today is that when they look at the episodes on the first and second seasons, there's a different theme song than what they're used to seeing on their local TV stations, or even originally when Cartoon Network started running the show. But what happened was there was a theme song on the first 2 seasons called Rise and Shine, which was an instrumental.
That was an instrumental version. It didn't have any lyrics at all, so it didn't really tell you anything about the characters. It introduced them all visually.
Come production time for the 3rd season, Bill Hanna decided he'd like to have a theme song with lyrics. And they took a background cue that had been in the show since the very first episode, since the swimming pool episode, which actually was not the first episode to air, but it was the first episode produced. And when they're having their little swinging party out by the swimming pool, this song is playing. So they took this song, and that was Meet the Flintstones, and that's the theme song that almost everybody knows, and it ran from the third through the sixth seasons. Then, when the show went off network and went into syndication, Bill Hanna decided that in those days, 16-millimeter film prints used to be bicycled around to all the local stations, so they would run completely out of order. And Bill Hanna decided that it would be too jarring for one day it's Rise and Shine, the next day it's Meet the Flintstones, and then the next day it's Rise and Shine again, and he just thought it would be too confusing, and so they stripped the Rise and Shine opening off the first two seasons and put one Meet the Flintstones opening on every episode.
The original theme was lost for many years. I remember telling people about it, and they'd look at me like I was nuts, you know.
Hoyt Curtin was a great composer. He started with Hanna-Barbera in the very beginning.
There were other studios making TV cartoons, but Hanna-Barbera was like head and shoulders above everybody else. They were the ones you went to.
Well, Bill and Joe were really pioneers in television animation.
Bill and Joe developed this technique. They just took it to an optimum, and it's this thing that sometimes it's referred to as limited animation. I prefer the term planned animation because you don't just limit everything.
Just the term limited immediately makes you think you're missing out on something, that there's parameters that are preventing you from doing other things.
The character designs are kind of more two-dimensional, a little flatter than what they were doing in theatrical, but they worked for television. They worked for this new medium.
Wherever the story seems to call for it, you might expand on it and make it a little richer. And then, so you have to be very judicious in your selection of what you did where. And planned animation consisted, of course, with an eye toward answering to the needs of a lower budget, a more compressed amount of time.
You know, they could use cycles and they could use, you know, different kinds of cheats, but I didn't see them as cheats because I felt they were very funny. And you look at later so-called limited animation, and that does feel kind of lacking in a lot of ways. But that early stuff, as long as you had strong poses, good gags, good soundtrack, great designs, good backgrounds.
If you notice on many of the early Hanna-Barbera characters, that there would be usually a line going from the nose area down, and it formed sort of a muzzle down to the lower part of the face. That was done purposely so that they could lift that area of the face in a controlled fashion, and just so they can synchronize the mouth to the dialogue and have that keep alive while the rest of the head was somewhat frozen, except for the eyes, possibly, which would blink.
I want a cartoon to be funny or dramatic and really hit it. And whether it was stuff like the Flintstones or Yogi Bear or Quick Draw McGraw or stuff like Johnny Quest and Space Ghost.
We see a lot of it today, but that was one of the first that really did that as successfully as the Flintstones did. And, you know, just the length of time that it ran would attest to that.
I think to my generation's taste, they gave us what we wanted.
Bill and Joe. They were the bosses. They were so close creatively and productively in terms of their careers. Socially, they didn't quite travel in the same directions. And yet, I can remember when I first started there that they used to have Each one of the desks were placed back to back, and they faced each other, so they could just toss ideas and drawings and keep in touch that way. It was about as close as you can get.
These guys were really, I mean, they, like I said, Joe came in every day, Bill came in every day. I mean, when I worked for them, they were already in their 70s, but they were still working every day, and they were very approachable.
Joe's a force to be reckoned with. You'd never know that he was an animation producer. He comes on like an old-time Hollywood producer.
Well, he's just, I was in awe of him. I remember when I was first working for him, and I mean, just had a wonderful personality, you know, funny, and he was so suave. You know, he's one of the best-dressed men, you know. He was just great, really. No complaints. I was glad, I mean, quite truthfully, to have to be on his team.
Bill seemed to concentrate more in terms of the organizational qualities of it, besides guiding the very creative area of animation itself. And he would take care of that. He would be responsible to a great degree of post-production.
Bill Hanna used to establish a schedule, like if when we were laying out a short, like say the Wally Gator shorts, I remember, were some of the earliest ones I worked on, or Huckleberry Hound. He would like us to lay them out in 5 days. That was kind of a tight schedule.
Bill Hanna was kind of the quiet one. And in the early days of Hanna-Barbera as a company, Bill was the guy who timed the shows. His sense of timing is impeccable in being able to time gags and make them work.
He'd leave a note like that if he had a question about something or wanted to make a change or tell somebody to add something or whatever. But it was really fun, especially in those early years, to take our layouts into him, and he'd go over them, you know, and he'd approve the stuff. And like I say, I learned so much from him.
I had an amazing experience with Bill Hanna once, where he walked in, and we had a Flintstone special we were doing, pinned up on the walls of this room. We wanted him to take a look at the storyboards before we started doing layout. And he walked through, and he hadn't even read the board before. And he's just in looking at it, and he's going, okay, well, cut this scene here. Don't have the character just walk off screen. Don't see him get in his car. You just hear the car door slam, then you cut to him, and he's in his car. And he would just go through this stuff like you or I were breathing. And he cut out all the unnecessary animation. He added gags. He streamlined the thing in an amazing, intuitive way.
And both of them contributed so heavily to what you saw coming out of the tail end of the material that came out, you know, out of that studio.
You know, the very first cartoon character ever in 1914, Winsor McCay's Gertie the Dinosaur. This was the first character animation ever. And I really feel it's wonderfully symbolic that the very first animation was of a dinosaur. And today we still celebrate the Flintstones, which feature dinosaurs and it's set in the Stone Age. There's something about animation and the Stone Age that fit together really well.
You've known people like this, and they aren't just concoctions, or you know, and I do believe that really comprises the essence of what makes shows like the Flintstones so long-lasting and so very, very popular.
I think we knew it was popular in the second season, but I don't think we knew just how popular. I think maybe by the fourth or fifth year, and of course, we had no idea that it would be running like even today in syndication.
But if the Flintstones themselves weren't appealing, I don't think it would have the same kind of legendary status with people.
I think the Flintstones will be around as long as there's television. It's timeless. It's the
perennial man versus woman family comedy. And then it's funny on top of everything else.